Hello, and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Richard Sleeper.
And I'm Jacob Austin. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, first, Mark Dunley talks with Dr. Brandon, who talks about the draft of a legally binding global treaty to end plastic pollution. Then, Marsha Lazarus talks to vendors at the Troy Farmers Market. Later on, Brea Barthel talks to Carol Roberts, who brings us her Troy Public Library Youth Book Picks for April. After that, to commemorate Autism Awareness Month, Lennox Aputo talks to Miss Darlene Bowman about Awesome Tech, an organization working with people with autism and coding. Finally, a Skidmore student talks about college dining halls in this week's American Taste segment. But first, here are the headlines.
The town of Wilton is likely to reject a push to add the toxic chemical fluoride to its water system. The city of Albany recently reversed its longstanding opposition to fluoridation, saying it would help with tooth decay. The TU reports that the chair of the Water and Sewer Authority Board, Dave McDougall, said that the authority strongly believes that our customers and their health care providers should have the right to make their own decisions on fluoride consumption.
Black families disproportionately enter and face harsher consequences in New York State's child welfare system, according to a report by the Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. The committee suggests that state lawmakers adopt sweeping reforms to how New York conducts investigations into child welfare, though committee members are divided as to what reforms are needed.
The UAlbany lacrosse coach is calling on the National Coaches Association to address repeated racist verbal abuse directed at minority players, including Native Americans.
The Cohoes Police Department is missing years of disciplinary records due to some being intentionally destroyed, poor record keeping, and one instance where the subject of an internal investigation was handed the file against him until to, quote-unquote, get rid of it. Recent court filings revealed that the current police chief had complained to the county district attorney 3 years ago about the situation.
The Gazette reports that the Schenectady Cooperative Extension Office is running a Little Diggers program in Central Park that gives preschool-aged children a chance to learn how to grow vegetables and other plants from seedlings to harvest time.
The Gazette reports the Schenectady City Council president at Monday's meeting said that the council won't commit to adopting a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. At the council's March 25th meeting, a slight majority of 30 residents who spoke regarding the ceasefire resolution opposed the idea, with representatives from local Jewish groups contending that a ceasefire resolution could bring about anti-Jewish sentiment in the community. Supporters of the resolution point out that the killing of children is evil, whether it is two local children recently killed or the tens of thousands being killed in Gaza.
Troy Mayor Carmelo Mantello recently announced Project Sentinel, a new safety program that will place four police officers in activity hotspots around the city.
The Albany County Legislature is considering a law to address so-called crisis pregnancy centers and how they inform people seeking care. These unregulated operations are often affiliated with religious groups and outnumber licensed abortion clinics in New York State. An Albany Medical Center study found that crisis pregnancy centers provide medical misinformation about reproductive care like abortion procedures. And those are all our headlines.
During Earth Week, negotiators from 175 countries are gathering in Ottawa to discuss progress in drafting a first-ever legally binding global treaty to end plastic pollution. Key issues include goals for reducing the amount of plastics produced and the role of recycling of plastics. Dr. Brandon, Associate Director of U.S. Plastic Policy for the Ocean Conservancy, provides an update to Mark Dunley.
We're talking with Dr. Anja Brandon is Associate Director of U.S. Plastic Policy for the Ocean Conservancy, and she is participating in, I believe it's the fourth session of the Intergovernmental Committee to develop a legally binding agreement on plastic pollution, which is taking place up in Ottawa, Canada. I believe hundreds of countries are represented. So Dr. Brandon, maybe you could just briefly, people probably can, you know, what is Ocean Conservancy's concern about plastics, and, you know, what are the key issues taking place at the plastic treaty meeting?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, the ocean has been ground zero for the plastic pollution crisis for decades. Each and every year, 11 million metric tons of plastic enter our ocean. To put that into perspective, that's over a garbage truck's worth of plastic entering our ocean every single minute. And we know all of that pollution in the ocean is really just the tip of the iceberg. All that visible pollution out in our ocean is hiding far more invisible threats, from microplastics to toxic chemicals to greenhouse gas emissions from the entire life cycle of plastics, since plastics are made out of fossil fuels. And we know this pollution doesn't know or obey geographic boundaries. This really is going to require all countries to come together, which is why we're so excited to be here at the fourth round of negotiations for what we're calling a global plastics treaty. Basically getting all of the countries on the same page to figure out how we're going to reduce plastics, better manage the plastics that we do end up using, and continue to clean up plastics that are already out in the environment.
So what are some of the key issues that the negotiators are trying to grapple with at this meeting? And do you expect a final agreement, or this is part of a longer process that goes on for a number of years?
Yeah, so this is the fourth of an expected five meetings to negotiate this treaty. The goal is to end the treaty negotiations by the end of this year. So we're on a pretty breakneck timeline. And this is the first treaty. This is the first negotiation where we're really seeing countries start to negotiate, to really grapple with the text and decide what's going to be in there. So some of the topics that are ripe for discussion: how are we going to reduce the amount of plastic we're making and using in the first place? Every single scientific model has shown that we need to start with reduction when it comes to solving this issue. So that's a really big issue that's being negotiated right now. And we go from really big issues like that all the way down to microplastics, a big issue, but, you know, a tiny plastic problem. So how are we going to prevent the use of intentionally added microplastics? What are we going to do with all the microplastics that shed or degrade from larger plastic items, and everything in between? So we're talking about extended producer responsibility policies to fishing gear that's made out of plastic, really taking a full life cycle comprehensive approach to the plastic pollution crisis.
So one of the debates we've seen in many states in the United States is, you know, the industry, you know, wants to focus on, let's do a better job of recycling plastics, whereas many environmental advocates go, it's very difficult to recycle plastics as compared to, say, glass or metal, and so therefore we have to focus more on stopping producing plastic or reduce the amount of plastic we produce. How is that type of tension playing out in these international treaties?
Yeah, that's a great tension, or that's a great question. We see this exact same tension playing out at the local level, the state level, the federal level, and of course here at the international level. And I think we often get caught in this either or framing. We either need to eliminate and reduce all plastic, or we need to recycle all plastic. And the truth of the matter, what the science tells us, is that it is a yes and problem at this point. We are so far gone into this crisis, it is an all hands on deck moment. Yes, we need to reduce the amount of plastic we're making and using. And yes, we need to improve real mechanical recycling of the plastic that we do end up still using to enable us to get off of fossil fuels in the first place, which are used to make all of our plastics. And so that's what we're hoping to see in this treaty, is that comprehensive approach that says, yes, and how can we move this forward on all fronts?
Now, one of the issues that does come up, at least in the United States, has been the issue of chemical recycling, which is, I guess, heavily promoted by the plastic industry. You know, many environmentalists argue that's not a great technology. Some people compare it to actually incineration of the plastic. How is that issue playing out in the treaty negotiations, and particularly where does the Biden administration stand on that?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I would say it's chemical recycling is the elephant in the room. It's not written down on any pieces of paper yet, but it's looming in the background over all of these discussions, because we know there's a very strong industry presence, as well as countries' presence, who are very motivated to see those types of technologies move forward. And the truth of the matter is, chemical recycling at this moment in time is just not recycling. It's not recovering plastics that we can reuse into new products. We've seen enough misinformation and consumer distrust in recycling as it is. Chemical recycling is only going to make that work, in addition to a whole host of environmental and public health harms that come with these technologies. So we're really trying to push away from these quick fixes or, you know, silver bullet technologies, because we know ultimately that's not what it's going to take, and that these technologies are a distraction from what we really need to be doing, which is talking about how we can reduce plastics in the first place. The Biden administration, again, has not put anything down on paper yet about these types of technologies in the international treaty. We've seen EPA issue some more positive rulemakings recently, you know, continuing to regulate pyrolysis and gasification, which are two types of these harmful chemical recycling technologies, as incinerators. So I'm hopeful that they follow through on that in the international space and try to focus on real solutions.
So we have about 2 minutes left. So I'm going to ask sort of a multi-part question in the 2 minutes. You know, in New York, a lot of the fight over plastic packaging has been, you know, trying to set actual concrete goals, say a 50% reduction in the amount of packaging and plastic within a 12-year period. Is that something that's occurring? Are you optimistic about the negotiations at this point? Where does it go from here? You say hopefully by the end of the year. And if people want more information, how can they get that all in 90 seconds?
Okay. No small feat. Where do things go from here? So we have another round of negotiations after this, and we're really optimistic that at this round of negotiations, we can get to something called intersessional work. So a mandate for countries to meet and continue talking and figuring this out before the next round of negotiations, so we can stay on this timeline. So that's where things head next. In terms of a target, you are spot on. We absolutely need a time-bound reduction target to really move the needle on this issue. Ocean Conservancy worked in California to do just that, a 25% reduction in single-use plastics over 10 years. Ocean Conservancy is calling for a 50% reduction in single-use plastics by 2050, so 50 by 50. To be included in the international treaty based on modeling what we know it's going to take to move the needle on this issue. And for folks who want to join us in calling for that and learn more, you can go to www.oceanconservancy.com/endplasticpollution.
Thank you very much. We've been talking with Dr. Andrew Brandon of the Ocean Conservancy, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That was Mark Dunley and Dr. Brandon talking about a global legally binding treaty to end to end plastic pollution. We will keep you updated on this story as more information becomes available.
Next, we take a trip into the Troy Farmers Market with Marshall Lazarus.
It's amazing, definitely with the waffles, to realize how we have become over the years part of the Saturday routine of so many families here in Troy.
This is Marsha Lazarus with Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm here at the Troy Farmers Market this morning. And if you can give me your name and what you're selling here.
My name is Luke. The name of the company is Pika's Farm Table, and we're a kitchen that uses local ingredients and turns them into different products, pot pies, quiches, soups, little appetizers, and then further down, that's the sweet, that's the savory side, and then further down, the waffle side, the Belgian sugar waffle, which we started in probably around 2010 at this market, and which has quite a following here in Troy.
Yeah, I can understand. They look delicious. Actually, everything does. And I'm intrigued that you have both the sweet items and the savory dishes. Lobster bisque, lobster pot pie, chicken pot pies. Oh my God, my mouth is watering.
The sweet side is due to my wife, who said, like, we're from Belgium. Me and my wife, we're both from Belgium, moved here to the U.S. in 94. And she kept saying, like, listen, we have to get to the sweet waffles. Yeah, the Liège waffle, the Belgian sugar waffle. It was trial and error because I took a Belgian recipe and took American ingredients and it didn't work. Because flour here in the US is milled much finer than it is in Europe. And butter, believe it or not, has less butter fat here in the US than it has in Belgium. And it's not a linear conversion. But with trial and error, I finally got it right. And then since we've been living here already so long, yeah, your frame of reference wears down, wears out. So I called my brother up in Belgium and I said, like, do you mind coming over? Yeah, and at the airport, eat a waffle and then fly over and taste ours. And he got here and he said, yeah, you're spot on. So that's when we started commercializing them.
And the true test is your sales.
Yeah. True, and it's not a bunch of Americans faking a Belgian sugar waffle, it's Belgians making Belgian sugar waffles. So it's basically I'm selling out my heritage. Yeah.
That is so interesting. Do you bring your beautiful stuff to other markets or other stands?
The majority of what we do, we're wholesalers. We're producers and wholesalers. Our biggest customer is Fresh Direct in New York City. They have 360 trucks making home deliveries, and they carry our pot pies, they carry our quiches, and that's really our biggest customer. But the big guys, to work for the big guys, you have to wait a long time for your money. The wholesale are way bigger numbers, but slimmer margins, and you need that. Yeah, the mix of both. Also, the big advantage of the farmers market for us is it's the cheapest way for me to try out new products, because I sample, and if it isn't any good, customers come back and rub it in your face that the product isn't good, and then you kill the product and you come up with something else. So the farmers market is to keep the company in balance, yeah, okay, between small orders and big orders. And because with big orders you lose
you can lose track of who you are and what you need to do. Yeah, to keep us grounded, that's the farmer's market. And also it's a tool for me to do product development and product testing in a very cheap way. Yeah.
Terrific. And it sounds like immediate feedback.
Yeah. Don't tell the Troy people that I consider them guinea pigs. But,
So the best place for people to sample your delicious, sweet, and savory items at the Pika's Farm Table stand at the Farmers Market every Saturday morning here in the atrium, and then later outside.
Yep, indeed.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah, nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you. Can you introduce yourself and your business?
Yes, I can. Hi there. My name's Rita, and I am from Adirondack Bakery. I've been actually doing this since 2012. I started out just doing craft sales, and I grew to do farmers markets. I'm currently doing the Troy Farmers Market, as well as the Schenectady Green Market, and I've never been happier.
And can you talk a little bit about your products? And your business is called Adirondack Bakery, but this is not a traditional bakery.
No, I basically do preservative-free, human-grade dog treats in all kinds of funky flavors. We have peanut butter bacon to a fat Elvis, to all different concoctions that I basically brought up over the years. Everything is a brown rice flour base, preservative-free, human grade.
So are you a cook? Are you a baker?
Absolutely. I come from a very strong Sicilian background. My mother was a wonderful cook. She's a wonderful baker. And one day in 2012, I was sitting on the couch as a single mom, and I needed to make more money. My love of dogs, my love of baking, I formed it, and it became Adirondack Bakery, which the name comes from my Stroon Lake cabin, which I love up in the Adirondacks. It's my place of relaxation, so that's where the name was formed.
And so you seem very relaxed, and you're enjoying yourself.
Love it. It took me in my 50s to really find my calling. Between the two markets, I'm working full time now, and I have never been happier.
And do you find that there's a large market for these products, which these are not typical dog treats or food, right? Normally people go...
They're very unique. And I think that people love the fact there's no preservatives and no added chemicals. There's oats, brown rice, flour, blueberries, all fresh, human grade. And people love the fact that it's all natural.
And so clearly there's a demand for your product that you're able to...
Oh, it's growing and growing, yes. Every year that I'm at the farmer's market, I'm getting more and more clients. And I love the people. I love seeing the dogs when we're outside. Just a wonderful experience.
Wonderful to see your very interesting stand. Stuff made from secondhand and vintage materials. What is your name, and can you talk a little bit about all your wonderful products?
Sure. So I'm Mariah. I hand make and upcycle bucket hats and jackets, shirts and scrunchies and all kinds of stuff. It's always made from secondhand or vintage materials. I try to keep it low waste and use up all my scraps, so a lot of my stuff will be patchwork, and it's usually one of a kind.
Such interesting stuff, and yes, so varied. I see you have jackets, spring jackets, very cool hats, scrunchies, beautiful shirts. Where did this and how did this idea evolve?
Well, I care a lot about sustainability, and I try to live like a very low waste lifestyle myself, and I just really like sewing. When I taught myself, I decided I would never buy anything new if I could avoid it, so ever since, I've never bought new fabric, like maybe thread and elastic are new, but otherwise nothing new. I just care about like not wasting. That's really like, there's so much waste in the world. We've overproduced so much that I just want to like reduce it in any way I can.
Interesting way also to use your artistic qualities, which you clearly have.
Thank you.
So How long have you been doing this, and how long have you been coming to the market here?
So this is my, I've been doing this for 3.5 years. August is my 4th anniversary. I've been sewing for 5. I taught myself. I've been coming to this market. This is my 3rd year, my 2nd winter, but my 3rd year.
And is it a fun experience, and is it a productive experience coming here?
It's very fun. I've met lots of cool people. I've connected with a lot of awesome customers and people who my work resonates with, which is so special to me. This market's allowed me to find people that like love my stuff, and that's like the best feeling in the world.
Wow. Do you sell your products anywhere else, or?
I do. I sell products at my shop in Saratoga. I have a little boutique studio. I sew right out of there, and I sell right out of there. It's on Beekman Street. I sell on my website, which is mariahfied.com. And I have an Etsy and a Depop that are my things are available on.
Thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate, and I love your stuff.
Thank you.
Good luck. Marsha Lazarus reporting from Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That was Marsha Lazarus at the Troy Farmers Market. It takes place every Saturday if you are interested.
For those just tuning in, I'm Richard Sleeper.
And I'm Jacob Boston. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Choi, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Choi, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, and streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
Emotions, ecology, earth, and a Japanese mythology story. Carol Roberts, head of Young People's Services at Troy Public Library, eases us into spring with 4 book recommendations.
Listeners, if you're parents or caretakers that are trying to find new books to share with younger people, Carol Roberts, head of Young People's Services at Troy Public Library, is here with a couple suggestions for books that talk about feelings and environment and Asian American Pacific Islanders Month in May. So, Carol, welcome back to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Hi, Bria. Good to be here.
So, Carol, what's your first book today?
My first book is called Little Faces, Big Feelings, What Emotions Look Like, and this is written by Amy Morrison. This is one of our newer books, and I just came across this and was very excited to see this. I do a story time each week, and this is a perfect book for toddlers, getting them comfortable with articulating their feelings or even just understanding what their feelings are.
The cover is interesting because it shows a diverse group of kids with very different facial expressions, 6 different photos of kids. So it looks like even just having kids identify like which one they're feeling on the cover could be helpful.
Yes. It has clear color photographs throughout. There's actually 10 for each emotion, and each feeling is paired with a brief rhyme and corresponding photos of multiple children in the midst of expressing that emotion. It includes brief discussion questions in the back that are ordered according to age. And it also includes a mirror at the back and a feelings wheel so kids can see what, or you can practice with your child what different emotions look like, and they can see what their faces look like when they may be feeling this. For example, here's one. It said, bored sometimes feels like nothing to do. When someone looks bored, we might try something new. And there's pictures of a bunch of children looking bored or restless. And I think it's great because it lets children know that what they're experiencing is not unusual, and just to be more comfortable with a variety of emotions.
I wonder if this would be especially helpful for autistic children because they have more difficulty reading the expressions and such.
You know, I didn't think about that, but that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, and there's also, I like this particular one about being brave. It says, being brave doesn't mean that you're not afraid. Sometimes things feel scary, but we try anyway. And there's all kinds of things that might be scary. Trying to catch a ball, trying a new kind of food, reaching up high for something and being concerned about maybe falling. But all these things help kids get comfortable. And so I love that. And they're so accessible. But each page, like I said, it'll articulate a particular feeling. And then you see kids in various situations coming to terms with that.
It's a beautiful book. For each two-page spread, the left page is a large photo with just a few words, like the ones she's read. And then the right page is 9 different smaller photos of kids of all different sizes and skin tones. And then the second book?
The second book I have is about Rachel Carson, and it's called Rachel Carson and Ecology for Kids, Her Life and Ideas, with 21 Activities and Experiments. And this is written by Rowena Ray. Rachel Carson's life and accomplishments are presented, but while introducing the concept of ecology, mixed throughout are boxes of information about her contemporaries, including people like Albert Schweitzer and E.B. White, who were big supporters and were of like mind. They wrote about her work and how important it was. But what I really like about this is that it's presented in bits and pieces, so it's easily digestible for kids. And also, intermixed are experiments and activities that kids can do. For example, charting bird migrations. Also, it asks them in some just to sit and be in nature and listen and pay attention. And so it's really encouraging a kind of mindfulness. But it also, what was interesting in this is that Rachel's life, she did quite a lot. You learn about her background and things that you never knew, which was that, of course, her book, Silent Spring, wasn't her only success story. She had other books published prior to that were also successful.
And Silent Spring, as many, probably most listeners know, was one of the big pushes for the environmental movement because it talked about how birds were disappearing because of the effect of DDT on production and growth of eggs.
Well, her book just had a profound effect on people and really drew people to take action. And so it was a pivotal moment in the beginning of the ecological movement.
What year did that book come out?
1962.
So even before Earth Day, a contributor to the movement that brought us Earth Day. What age group would you say the Rachel Carson book is for?
I would say ages 10 and up.
And that's Rachel Carson and Ecology for Kids, Her Life and Ideas with Activities and Experiments. You always pick such interesting books. The next one is?
The next book I have is called My Friend Earth, written by Patricia McLaughlin and illustrated by Francesca Sana. This shows Earth as a brown-skinned girl who's actually a giant, and it's full of a soft color palette of peach, sage, and turquoise, which really makes it a soothing kind of read when combined with McLaughlin's very lyrical prose. There are die cuts and curved flaps, which are interspersed throughout, and they really add interest as her story unfolds over the course of a year and really shows a connectedness between all aspects of nature, both living and inert.
Now, when she says they're die cuts, it's like each page has a different curve to it, and there's a butterfly cutout where you see on one page, and then you flip the page, and there's a different kind of cutout. This must be expensive to produce.
Oh, I would imagine so, very much.
But it certainly is beautiful.
I love this. Here's a passage, just a short one I'll read. The tundra where the reindeer graze for moss, and the glistening ice where the young polar bear pads on mittened feet.
So it's showing that same dark-skinned girl traveling through the earth or being the earth. And the pictures, the colors are just incredible.
Yeah, it really depicts how she cares for us. And so you really do get a sense of the connectedness of us all through nature.
And what age group would you say this is for?
Ages 3 to 7.
3 to 7, yeah, because there's less text and wonderful pictures. So it's between the picture book for sort of pre-verbal or pre-readers and the Rachel Carson book. And the title again is My Friend Earth. And you said you have one more?
One more. And this last book, of course, is my favorite. This is a new book we just got. It's called Tokyo Night Parade, and it's a story by J.P. Takahashi, and the art is by Minako Tamagahara. This is about a little girl participating in the night parade, which is a tradition in Japan. And it's a parade of 100 demons. And she is with her dog and a friendly froggy kind of spirit known as a kappa. And you'll notice the illustrations are Disney-esque. And there's lots of lush violets and purples. And you can see what I mean about it being Disney-esque. It looks like a movie tie-in edition from a Disney film. But look at the color. The colors are just striking. You've got corals, brilliant corals and purples.
Purples and magentas and other pinks and mountains in the distance and kids in the front. It is beautiful.
And the demons are adorable. They're not scary at all.
So we're not talking vampire slayer demons.
Not at all. And so she's this cute little girl. She's Japanese and of African descent as well. And so she's wearing a fox suit. I forgot the name for it, but there's a name in Japanese for this type of garment. And so the demons keep asking her when they will see her again. Of course, she's not sure because she lives in New York now. And so she doesn't know when she's next going to be able to come back to Japan. But this is her favorite night of the year. It's just a wonderful story.
And what age group would you say this is for?
Ages 4 to 8.
It's beautiful. And actually, it's for anybody who enjoys beautiful washes of color. Even if you just stop by to look at it in the library, it's beautiful. So those books again were?
The Tokyo Night Parade, My Friend Earth, Rachel Carson and Ecology for Kids, Her Life and Ideas with 21 Activities and Experiments, and Little Faces, Big Feelings.
Thanks a lot. That was Carol Roberts, Head of Young People Services at Troy Public Library. For more information, you can go to the website thetroylibrary.org or stop by the library at 100 2nd Street in Troy. But be warned, it is a large plywood encasement of the library because of work going on, but the library will be open and they have signs to get you to the door. Carol, thanks so much.
Thanks, Bria.
That was Bria Barthel talking with Carol Roberts about April's Troy Public Library book picks. For more details, visit thetroylibrary.org.
April is Autism Awareness Month. In this next segment, Lennox Aputo highlights Awesome Tech, an organization that empowers students on the autism spectrum by providing vocational training through teaching them block-based coding and other skills.
We're joined today by a very esteemed guest, a personal mentor of mine, a trailblazing woman, an educator, and a human being with a very generous heart. She is a professor of English at the College of Staten Island, as well as the founder for Awesome Tech. Her name is Ms. Darlene Bowman. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Lennox. It is really a pleasure to be here, especially for Autism Awareness Month. Appreciate you.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to have you here. So my first question is, how would you define autism or an individual on the autism spectrum?
So I like this saying. There's a saying that goes, if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. And so like autism is just really like having a unique way of seeing and interacting with the world. It can be characterized by difficulties with communicating with others and social interactions. Some people on the spectrum might find certain things like noises, colors to be overly stimulating. Changes in routine can be difficult to handle. The social interactions are really noticeably different, you know, in some, or challenging for many people on the spectrum. But it also means that they may have special talents and interests that make them really awesome in their own way. Just like you and I are different, everyone is different. People with autism are also. And to me, that's just part of what makes us all diverse and makes us all wonderful.
Right. I mean, it's amazing. One thing that I did not know before I had the chance, and we'll talk more about this, interning for your organization, is how diverse people are who are on the autism spectrum.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, a very enlightening thing for me to learn as well, because before getting to intern with you and getting to interact with the students, mm-hmm. I had more of like just a knowledge about autism,
yeah.
But not, I hadn't interacted with people that, or like a lot of people that have the lived experience. So it was amazing to learn from them, to share with them, and to see how they learn.
Yeah, so you know that, I'm sorry to interrupt, but like that yeah. is really a huge part of what is needed, is more interaction, because you got to meet, you know, the students that you work with. They're all different. They're all like so talented in very unique ways. And the public really needs to see that. Mm-hmm. Businesses need to see that. You know, just everybody needs to really have that experience that you mm-hmm. just shared.
Right. And because we just briefly mentioned your organization, Awesome Tech, for the listeners, could you explain to them what it is that Awesome Tech does?
Of course. Our motto at Awesome Tech is creating opportunities in tech for young adults with autism. And so like through Awesome Tech, I'm really able to provide vocational and recreational computer science education to alternate assessment students with autism and now with intellectual disabilities in computer science. So basically, as you know, we create games, we do web design, digital art. We you know, the students learn to be creators using virtual reality, augmented reality, and now, of course, artificial intelligence. We participate in challenges with organizations like Girls Who Code. We actually just completed an AI for Financial Good challenge with Girls Who Code. We build games virtually with students from the United Arab Emirates through the International Games Exchange Program. We did that for, I think, like 3 years in a row. My students presented at CUNY Games conferences as high school students. And not only were they the only high school team, but they were the only groups with autism to present at the CUNY Games conference. Through Awesome Tech, we also run like programs for younger students, for middle school and elementary school students, both with and without disabilities. And as you may know, Jonathan, who is my former student and now my current partner running Awesome Tech with me, he has autism and dyslexia, but it really hasn't stopped him from being an amazing creator and now an instructor.
And we will come back and talk about Jonathan as well, because it was amazing for me to actually see one of your students go ahead and get an amazing opportunity, you know?
Yeah.
So you mentioned exchange programs, you've mentioned conferences that the students have been able to participate in. And I've also seen the work that they do in terms of building games and how just satisfying it is to watch someone create things like that. And, you know, apart from just, because I'm sure like it's amazing for you to watch your students grow and do really great work, I'm interested in what else made you decide to start this organization.
I was a District 75 teacher. District 75 in New York City is self-contained special education. And my students are alternate assessment. So that means they do not take standardized exams. They do not attend classes with students without disabilities, with general education students. And so I just, you know, I would spend from the age of 13 till about 21 with students, and you're planning their future and you're preparing them for life after high school. And then what I found was they lose the opportunities for that, I guess, that like intellectual engagement, that academic engagement, and just even the creativity. Like they just lose the opportunity to do something that they really love. And so I was a computer science teacher. My students had very, very many passions, and I tried to provide vocational learning experiences based on their passions. But once they graduate, there really wasn't a lot of opportunity out there for them and in any area, and then especially in computer science. So I used to tell my parents that based on what their students' interests are, I was like, you know, if that doesn't exist for them when they graduate, you're going to have to like kick down the doors. And if there's no doors there, you got to make the door. You have to build what you want for your child. And so I just decided, I just got tired of seeing my students who love computer science graduate and then don't have it anymore. I didn't want to keep looking at that.
Right. So it's brilliant. You chose to create something to fill in a gap that was there for your students. And so when you like had your first cohort of students, were they students that you had got in high school, or were they people that you also got from the community in Staten Island?
Yeah. So initially I started with my core group of graduates. And I have some students that are still in high school. As you may know, computer science, although there's a huge push to have every child in New York State, and I mean, really across this country, have meaningful computer science courses, we're not there yet as an educational system. And especially in District 75, there's even fewer opportunities. So I forgot the question.
Oh, we're talking about your first cohort of students, and you mentioned that.
So my first cohort has students that are still actually in high school, but they get their computer science fix with me outside of school. And and then my students that are graduated that love computer science, we do fairs, and we have a decent presence here on Staten Island. So I've been able to partner with major institutions like Wagner, where you graduated from, and of course, CUNY College of Staten Island. And so we are definitely open to the public, and people have heard about us, they see us at fairs, and they want to get involved. So I am not as expanded as I need to be. I literally have a wait list of about 35 families right now. Wow. But it's just me. So I'm very much still in startup mode. So to answer your question, yeah, it's my core group. It's students that I know, also mixed with some students that we've encountered at our various public outings. And then I like to include, you know, the family members because it's a bonding time also for them. So some of my students attend with their siblings, with their friends. You know, everybody's invited. You don't have to have autism to attend because that's not the way the world works anyway. The world is not just like everybody with autism in this one setting here, and then everybody else is doing something else somewhere else. No, it should be integrated.
That was Lennox Aputo talking to Ms. Darlene Bowman about Awesome Tech. They will be taking a trip to view MIT's robotics lab at the end of the month. If you would like to support, there is a link on our website at mediasanctuary.org.
Hope you're hungry, because it's time for this week's American Taste segment. In this episode, Skidmore student Campbell Smith talks to us about one of the most sacred places on any college campus, the dining hall.
My name is Campbell, and today we're diving deep into a topic that's very close to every student's heart, college dining halls. We're going to explore the evolution of these culinary centers before, during, and after the COVID-19 pandemic. It's no secret that college dining halls play a crucial role in the campus experience. They're not just for food. Dining halls help forge friendships, late-night study sessions are fueled, and memories are made. But in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, these hubs of student life went through some major changes. Today, we'll take a look at college campuses and unravel the story of college dining halls' transformations and adaptions from the pandemic. They navigated social distancing, hygiene, and remote learning while continuing to serve up delicious meals. We'll also look at where college dining halls are now. With the pandemic in the rearview mirror, what has changed, and what practices are still impacting the dining halls today? To help us understand better, we'll hear from Dave, a member of Skidmore College's dining hall staff. Dave began working at the Murray Aikens Dining Hall right before the pandemic hit. He will provide us with some insight into what the dining hall looked like throughout all these phases.
What was your personal overall work experience like during the pandemic? I started right in the beginning of the pandemic. From what I know is we shut down and we started doing bag lunches and bag dinners and snacks at night. And we would bag those up for 8 hours a day. And then we would hand them out to students during dinner time from like 5 to 7. Dining hall, nobody could come into. It was just the employees. I think spa was shut down. And we would just bag up lunches and dinners.
And so during the winter, did students have to come outside?
Yep, students would have to come outside. We would sit up in front of dining hall with tables and chairs and bags of food, and we'd just hand them out. People would come up in a line, and we'd just hand them out, and they'd go along their way.
And so it seems like we don't have, you know, sometimes you still see the hand sanitizer buckets out and, you know, precautions and the social distancing signs out places. Do you think the pandemic sort of implemented any positive policies that are still in place?
Just in the sense that I think it's just everyone's gone back to their normal life, so nothing that we've implemented from COVID has really stuck. I guess maybe more aware of like food handling, but that's really it. I guess the only thing that we do is the quarantine meals that we have. If people are sick and they can't come in, that's the only thing that we have implemented from then. Still, that happens, yeah.
And then, you know, you say we're back to normal pretty much. Mm-hmm. How long do you think that transition took from us sort of slowing down and being
a good year and a half from when we like COVID actually was like, okay, we're good, and they started opening up? It took about a good year and a half, I'd say, for us to go back to self-serve and stuff like that, because they still wanted to make sure that people were getting sick and everybody still wanted to make sure that, you know, people were safe.
Obviously, it's a tough question, but if another pandemic arose, would Skidmore be ready to handle that again? Or at least quicker?
We would have, quickly, I'd say more in a quicker response, yes. We would have, you know, we'd be like, all right, we've already been through this. So we already have like a procedure, I would say, set up in case it does happen again. But knowing how pandemics are, you can never, ever really be ready for it.
Before the COVID-19 pandemic, college dining halls were bustling hubs of social activity and culinary exploration. Students would gather to enjoy all-you-can-eat meals, often buffet style, with a wide variety of food options ranging from pizza and burgers to healthier options like salads and stir-fry. It was common to see long tables filled with friends chatting, studying, or simply enjoying a meal together. There's a sense of freedom in selecting your meals, and students would often only get meals at their dining halls. While the pandemic brought significant changes like prepackaged meals and a lack of community spaces, once the pandemic hit, colleges had to scrounge for solutions to feeding their students as quickly as possible. Some colleges struggled more than others. While Skidmore handled the crisis relatively smoothly, other colleges and universities did not. Cooper Smith, a freshman at NYU during 2020, will help us understand the struggle from a student perspective.
My dining hall experience was very, very interesting. The dorm I was in was a Palladium, which has a dining hall in it. But the main kind of, the highlight, I guess, of the dining hall experience, the most I could talk about, was during my 2-week quarantine that I had to do. You would have to be quarantined in your dorm for 2 weeks. And while you're there, you're not allowed to leave or see anybody other than your roommate or suite mate. So we had our food delivered to us daily, three meals a day, breakfast, lunch, dinner. Every day, it was just a little bit different and a little bit off. Sometimes things were missing, things that we had put in to be ordered were not given to us, and we got something entirely different. I heard many stories from other people who were vegetarian or vegan and were not accommodated well. There's one story in particular where somebody who was vegetarian only received a single slice of salami in a little like paper container. And that just kind of goes to show that it was not that well coordinated, and they hadn't done a good job at fully fleshing out and being prepared to accurately and properly accommodate everyone. the worst meal I got during that time was the infamous watermelon chicken salad. Oof. Yes. And if you're wondering what exactly was in it, that's exactly what it sounds like. There was some leaves, some cold, chopped, slightly shredded chicken, and then just a couple slices of watermelon slapped on top of it. And by the time we got it, the watermelon had seeped into everything, and it was just this gross, like, mushy kind of overall disgusting. I will say they did kind of do kind of the best move, which was giving everybody who was in a two-week quarantine a $300 Grubhub gift card. Then I will say, kind of the rest of my experience, once things had, you know, I was able to actually go straight to the dining hall and get food there, it was just kind of average dining hall food. For the COVID restrictions, it was very much, you go in, obviously everything's masked up, you go and you get your food and you leave with your food and eat it back in your dorm or wherever. It was very easy for me because I was living in the same dorm building that had a dining hall, but a lot of the dorm buildings at NYU don't. So a lot of people had to come to Palladium, pick up their food, and immediately leave. I don't believe dining halls opened to be kind of sat in until sophomore year, 2021. They started to kind of open things up a bit more. And then in the spring semester of my sophomore year, they'd finally kind of like started to get back to normal.
At New York University, the students' meals were dropped off at their doors during quarantine. The meals that were dropped off had issues: a sandwich for a student with gluten allergies and salads with chickens for a vegetarian. Also just plain weird food like a lemon as a side dish or some lettuce in a bag. While this was representative of the extreme side for poor planning, most colleges were really struggling with trying to supply food to students. To ensure the safety of students and staff, many institutions implemented measures like reduced capacity, social distancing, and enhanced sanitation practices. Buffet-style dining often shifted to prepackaged or to-go options, limiting self-service. Some colleges provided students with gift cards to popular food delivery services like Grubhub, Uber Eats, or DoorDash. Additionally, some colleges expanded outdoor dining spaces to promote open-air dining. While these changes were necessary for health and safety, they've reshaped the college dining experience with greater emphasis on flexibility, convenience, and hygiene. Now that COVID-19 is seemingly in the past, colleges are starting to recover from their policies and practices that were implemented. Dining halls have evolved after the pandemic to prioritize safety and flexibility. You'll find enhanced sanitation measures with more frequent cleaning and hand sanitizing stations. However, not all of the impacts of COVID were beneficial. Due to the pandemic, many colleges, including Skidmore, had to cut down on staff members that they have yet to bring back, making it much more difficult to run a functional kitchen. Although the policies put into place can be frustrating at times for staff and students, dining services know how to approach the issue of student quarantines. It's been an interesting trip through the evolution of college dining halls before, during, and after the pandemic. We've explored the ways these spaces have adapted to new challenges, from contactless meals to a relatively normal and bustling center. As we wrap up today's show, let's savor the thought that while college dining may have changed, one thing remains constant: the resilience and innovation of the staff of each college's dining hall who makes these spaces run successfully.
That was Skidmore student Campbell Smith for this week's episode of American Tastes. And that's our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Richard Sleeper.
And I'm Jacob Austin. Our engineer is the incomparable Sina Bazila Hickey. We thank all our volunteers who made today's episode possible. Shouts to Mark Dunley, Marsha Lazarus, Brea Barthel, Lennox Aputo, Campbell Smith, and our rookie of the year, my guy, Richard Sleeper, right next to me. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And to you, our listener, for making this all worthwhile. We will catch you on Monday.